Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Rachel Rudolph. Rachel is a distinguished scholar, in particular on resistance strategies, especially Islamic movements in Algeria, Palestine, and the Philippines. And her among her books are Terrorism and Politics, Mobilizing Movements, Mobilizing Contemporary Islamic Resistance, and Saudi Arabia's War on Terrorism. Rachel, it's been a good while. It's really terrific having you back on again to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. My God, the last time you were here on the program, many months back, there was always turmoil in the region, let's face it. But my God, the entire region has erupted from Morocco to the far eastern corners, and with a special concern about what's going on in Libya. And we have, on top of it, we have enemy number one, quote unquote, bin Laden, allegedly killed last Sunday. Jump in and comment. You jump in anywhere. You know, I honestly don't know what part of the region to suggest begin with first, so I will let you make that choice. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a good time, a long time since we've had this opportunity to chat.
Oh, it is. The last time you were on was before you were heading off to do some research on your newest book, and I know you spent some time in Russia, and you've done a lot more since then, but I'll let you comment on what's going on and so on.
Well, I'd say with the things taking place in the region, that there's some exciting things in the sense of different movements that are taking place on the ground among the people. And I think it's largely reflective of this thing that you feel when you travel, whether it's within Europe or whether it's in Central America, because that, as you know, as after I left Russia, I spent a good bit of time in Central America. But from North America to Central America, all throughout Europe and the Middle East, you have this sense on the ground of leadership that does not represent the people, and leadership that doesn't also comprehend what the different shifts that are taking place. And so I think that is a benefit to what is taking, or suggests potential change within the region and on the ground and in terms of leadership. But at the same time, then you have states such as the United States and others that are continuing to play their hand at traditional foreign policy paradigms that have proven in the past to fail and will continue to do so until they understand the changes that are taking place.
Oh, indeed. So I'm very impressed. I think you are, and most other people, with the popular uprisings. And I think in most places, at least most of the countries where they're happening, and I started to count the countries where there have been any form of uprising, and some get more coverage than others. But I got up to 12 and then stopped. I mean, I think it's over a dozen of the Middle East, North African countries that we've seen these uprisings, and nearly all of them, you've got genuine popular feelings of people who want change. And the issues may vary a little bit from country to country, but I think overall we're talking about things like poverty, government corruption, high unemployment, really great deprivation that these people go through, and in so many of these countries, political repression, and virtually no rights. And you stick your head up and protest, and they can stick you in a dock cell somewhere, and nobody ever sees or hears from you again. And I think Libya is different. Libya, by the way, I don't call any of the uprisings revolutions. I call them popular uprisings. Libya, though, is different. Libya, I don't think of Libya as a revolution. I think of it as an insurgency. And, we don't know the details going back many months, but I honestly believe, Rachel, that what's going on in Libya is a Western-inspired, planned, financed, manipulated event to get rid of Gaddafi, even though we brought him in or he came in from the cold back around 2003. He never was fully with the program, so I think for a number of years he was targeted to go, and they just picked their moment when they wanted to unleash the uprisings, and they enlisted people inside Libya, maybe others outside that they brought in that they could use against him. And I think that's really what's going on.
There are also two parallels between Libya and Syria, in the sense that you have both of the insurgencies within inside the country, or the unrest, because I don't want to call Syria an insurgency yet, but the unrest in Syria. Both of them began after they reestablished relations or attempted to reestablish relations with the United States. Because if you figure the unrest didn't begin until after we reinstated ambassador with inside Syria, and then there are reports from different or former government officials in the U.S. that Libya was planned back before 2003, but then hardcore after 2003. With the whole greater Middle East plan, or the new, or for a better terminology, they dubbed it the new Middle East plan.
Oh, indeed. I mean, America for some years. In 2006, as I understand, Rachel, Condoleezza Rice coined the term, I think, a new Middle East, and replacing the former term, greater Middle East. But I guess the idea basically is for America to control with no challenges the entire Middle East, North African region, and really getting into Central Asia. I think you could really talk about Eurasia, which covers everything from, east of Germany, everything east of Germany to include China and Russia. But, you take the big dominoes at the very end. I think the end game to everything going on, who knows if we'll ever get there, but I think the end game is challenging China and Russia. China, because of its economic might, gaining so fast on America, and Russia, because it's the only military rival of America. They both have these huge nuclear arsenals and delivery systems where they can deposit their powerful bombs anywhere on Earth pretty quickly. So
I would argue that Russia is also a foreign policy rival to the United States as well, because if you look at the new foreign policy paradigm that has emerged between the emerging powers, not just Russia, but also India, China, mainly the BRIC countries, and then Turkey also has implemented that type of foreign policy paradigm where it's multidimensional in nature. You're engaging actors, both state and non-state actors, irrespective of their ideological platforms and backgrounds, and in an attempt to quell conflict, which is quite contrary to the foreign policy paradigm that's implemented by the United States and some of the other European countries, including the European Union, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Too many of the EU countries go along with what we want to do, especially Britain, France. But I don't hear any objections out of the countries. At the beginning of the Libyan business, Germany was a little bit, their tone was different from Washington and from London and Paris. But I didn't hear any objection out of the Chancellor Angela Merkel. And I think Germany pretty much has gone along, and they've agreed to supply forces for what's going on. I think ships. And if there's a ground invasion, and I honestly expect a ground invasion, I expect the pretext to be gotten. The usual one, Rachel. The humanitarian crisis has really spun so out of control, and the shock and awe bombing simply hasn't done any good. So, I mean, the only way to resolve this thing, for humanitarian reasons, quote unquote, is to bring in the Marines, which of course is ridiculous. And I mean, I really see it creeping towards something like this. And there's no question that we want to get rid of Gaddafi for a lot of reasons. It certainly isn't because he's a despot. And I've said on this program before, as despots go, if you had to live under one, you'd want to live under one like him.
Yeah. I was talking this morning when I was because Libya, at least under Gaddafi, you had one of the positive aspects, which is something we don't have here in the United States, is that everybody has a right to a house or an apartment.
And an education and health care. He even gave newlyweds, Rachel, a stipend. Students who wanted to study abroad and who are qualified, admitted to a foreign university, he paid their tuition and expenses. Who ever heard of a despot doing anything like that? Would Obama do that for a student here? Hell no.
Heck no. No, because we need because looking at the U.S. society, I mean, it's consumerism at its best. It's all about materialism and getting over on the other rather than caring for.
Oh, absolutely. We are the most heartless of societies. I need to find new adjectives to describe the way our government is run, and it doesn't matter whether we've got a Bush there or an Obama there. It's really the same system, just the names and faces change, but the policies stay the same. So Obama just seamlessly followed the Bush policies, but he really bettered him. Bush was waging two wars, and Obama is waging four, plus, you know, the usual proxy ones, Somalia and Colombia. Nobody ever thinks about Colombia. Jeez, we've been at war in Colombia for years, but nobody talks about it. Well, that's another topic.
Yeah, or Honduras. We could talk about
Honduras
too.
Oh, and Haiti, and Palestine, and Yemen, and now Syria. We always partner with Israel in all of their wars. So the 2006 Lebanon War, the 2008-2009 Gaza War, Operation Cat's Lead. I mean, these are joint U.S.-Israeli operations. You know, Israel is flying the planes and dropping the bombs and all that, but they get billions of dollars from us. Our tax money is buying those planes and bombs and guns. So it's a partnership, and everything Israel does, we are in on it basically from the beginning. We know about it, and I don't think Israel would do anything that radical unless they got a green light from Washington to do it.
And if you look at our military sales and shipments to Israel, each time before there's a conflict or a military strike against the Gaza Strip, you have a large shipment or sales to Israel. And one of the speculation is because with the upcoming Nakba celebrations and internationals from around the world supposing to descend upon Egypt to march to Gaza, you have you just had that large military shipment to Israel. But so there's speculation among some scholars, the notion that it's potentially because of a potential attack on Iran, as especially since the Israeli military has been conducting practice operations in a potential strike with Iran. So.
Oh, absolutely, and this stuff goes on all the time, Rachel. So you have these hideous things that are never reported in the U.S. media. And, of course, the reporting on what's going on in the region right now is such gross misreporting. And I don't want to leave out of this program, we can jump back anywhere in the region you like, but I don't want to leave out of this program. It's been my first chance to comment on it on my own program. I've already had several interviews on this, and I'm writing my third article on it today, and I'm talking about the big May Day events. Round-the-clock headlines, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin
yes.
Laden. Well, let me tell you my view.
Let me say this. You have to question the timing of the release because there were reports and speculations back and the photos that were released back as far back as 2001 suggesting Bin Laden was killed then as opposed to now. And so regardless of whether it was then or now, I mean, that's debatable, but you have to question why it was taken, why released at this particular time.
It's always a strategic moment. There's no question about it, and we'll understand that better as time goes by. I have no doubt in the world, Rachel, that Bin Laden died in mid-December 2001 of natural causes. Nobody stormed into his hospital room, which is where he was, and shot him. David Ray Griffin wrote the important work on this. He wrote a book in 2009, I think, and he'll be on this program later in May. We'll get into that. We'll talk about his latest writing, his latest books as well. He's done the best work on 9/11, written a number of books, but his book was called Osama Bin Laden, Dead or Alive. Oh, he made a case you could take into a courtroom, Rachel, and even get a biased jury to, they would have to blanch not to go along with it. The evidence is so overwhelming that Bin Laden died of natural causes. There was a lot of stuff in it. There was some stuff that I added in my first article that on September 10th, 2001, Dan Rather on CBS News reported that Bin Laden was in a Rawalpindi, Pakistan hospital. Le Figaro newspaper in France in July wrote that he was in a Dubai hospital and he was visited in his hospital room by the Emirates CIA station chief. Well, how on earth did something like that happen? Because Osama served a dual purpose. On the one hand, he was quote-unquote enemy number one, and on the other hand, he was a long-standing CIA asset recruited through Pakistani intelligence, their ISI. So we used him advantageously both ways, so the CIA guy wanted to visit to see how his asset was doing. But he was a very sick man. A couple of more comments, too, and this was in David's book, that after he died, this was confirmed by former Pakistan President Musharraf, Benazir Bhutto, before she was killed, former FBI head of counterterrorism. I don't have his name in front of me. It may have been Watson, but he confirmed that he was dead. Oh goodness! There were some others that I mentioned. Other names that everybody would know who said, he's dead. That's right. And there was a top Taliban official who also said it. You can believe him or not, but he said he attended his funeral. Well, I believe it.
Isn't it quite coincidental that all of them have been subsequently removed from?
Well, I think that was one of the reasons why Bhutto was killed. I mean, I think she may have been the first one to spill the beans. I think she made a serious blunder. She may have made some others as well. but you can't let the terrorists we want to keep alive. You can't let people think that the guy is dead because we keep bringing out these videos. The videos were fake. They absolutely were fake. I wrote about one forensic video expert who dissected two of them in particular and showed that, they were even crude fakes. There were so many splices, audio and video. He even thought the audio on one versus another wasn't Bin Laden. It was somebody else imitating him. That's how crude they were. But they were fakes. And they always came out at strategic moments. So this alleged killing, Rachel, there's something strategic about this, and I don't think it is good.
No. I mean, there are so many different things as to potential reasons as to why it could have why it came out at this time. I mean, you have the increasing domestic dissent in the United States. You have the day before the release, you had the announcement that of Israel engaging in military strikes for a potential war with Iran. You have the situation, the reports on the fabrication of some of the unrest within Syria. I mean, there's just so much that kind of, with the death of bin Laden, that it overshadows so much, and then powers that be can play their hand at attempting to so-called fix things in their interest.
Oh, it doesn't fix things. I don't think Washington wants to fix things, Rachel. I think they want to stir the pot, because I've ridden twice in detail on this. This country literally has a permanent war agenda. I mean that literally. The idea of there not being at least one war ongoing, I mean a visible one everybody knows about, not the ones that go on covertly or the proxy ones. They go on all the time. Mm-hmm. But I mean a real visible one, like Vietnam and the war against Iraq, first the Gulf War, which ended too fast, and now the second Iraq War, Afghanistan, Libya. So you've got all these wars going on, and the idea that there would be no war would drive the war profiteers crazy, including so-called private military contractors. This vast network of private military contractors, their entire business is based on war. And when I use the term war profiteers, that goes way, way beyond the defense contractors. The technology firms alone, I mean, all these weapons need sophisticated technology. So that's a big part of their business. And don't forget Wall Street, because anything involved with war involves money, and that means Wall Street is involved. So you suddenly end all these wars today, bingo, they're over, the troops are coming home tomorrow, and you would see the stock market crash 1,000 points in one day and stay down, not go down and come back up. It would go down and stay down and maybe crash another 1,000 the next day, because it would be a major hit to the economy. So they keep these wars going without end. So I think we want this. In my third article today, I cite a few reasons for the timing. Obama's sagging image, his approval rating jumped from 46% to 57%. I thought it would jump more than that, diverting attention from the domestic situation. We have a deepening Main Street depression for most people in the country. So you try to raise the patriotism flag and divert people's attention from what they really should be focusing on, and also hyping fear, not reducing the threat of war, but increasing the threat of more war, justifying it, because we say, you know, I mean, we have this serious war on terror going on, and now that we got rid of the top bad guy, probably there'll be some revenge attacks, so we have to be vigilant and do more to counteract these or prevent them. So that means more militarism, more attacks, maybe more wars, allegedly to go after threats to our national security, but it really is to wage more wars for more power and more money.
And to quell domestic dissent. Let me share a story with you. My last semester teaching this past fall, what we were talking about, because it was a class right after the FBI had conducted those massive raids on the anti-war protesters, and confiscated their computers and files and all that kind of stuff. There is such a growing sense of acceptance of a military or police culture within certain parts within the United States that it's worrisome for what the future holds for the younger generation. You had kids endorsing the calls for assassination for the Julian Assange. I mean, 10 years ago, you would never have such talk of such things domestically. And in terms of the arrest on the for the anti-war protesters, a lot of the kids were even supportive of the use of soft forms of torture for domestic dissent. I mean, there's significant change that's taking place that that parallels what's our foreign policy in our continuation of wars abroad.
Oh, absolutely, Rachel. I mean, it really is. Most people don't know the half. Don't know the half. Just an expression. They know so little about what's going on, not just overseas, but at home. And the policies are just so outrageous. And I mean, no respect for the law, no respect for the needs and concerns of people here or anywhere else in the world. I mean, I have to contain myself from laughing if it weren't so tragic that people believe that we could go into a place like Libya for humanitarian reasons or to bring democratic values. I mean, we don't give a damn about these things at home. Why on earth would we give a damn about them in Libya or any place else? We don't.
And all we have to do is look at our rendition program.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're still renditioning people illegally to be tortured in foreign prisons, getting people. I mean, we do enough of it ourselves at Guantanamo and so many other U.S. bases, but we also send them to Saudi Arabia and to Poland or Romania, wherever these bases are, and they shift them around every now and then. You know, if one of them becomes public information, they'll shift it someplace else because they want to keep these things secret. We even have torture ships, or at least we did during the Bush administration, torture ships that are in the middle of some ocean, and talk about no observation of what's going on, and I can't imagine anybody ever came back from that to talk about it, but they did, and they talked about what went on, and a couple of cases, there were people who were in some of the other prisons, and they called being on one of these ships the worst form of torture of all, because you're literally out of sight, out of mind. Nobody knows you exist or where or what's happening or anything. And these are the policies of this country. And we call ourselves a democracy with respect for human rights and the law, Rachel.
We have been a long participant in the continued culture of impunity, where states are not held accountable, at least powerful states are not held accountable for their human rights violation and their crimes against humanity, which is sad. There's a reason why people view the American government as a hypocritical. I mean, we say one thing, but yet with the other hand, we do something else.
Oh, absolutely. We're almost out of time. I want to get this in as well. Tell listeners what you're doing right now with your new publication.
Oh, we just launched an online magazine called Encompassing Crescent. It is, what it seeks to do is to promote dialogue, bringing in the different sectors, because right now in the different social media venues, you have ordinary individuals talking together, activists talking together, politicians talking together, and political leaders of different movements and parties and so forth, but none of them talking together within one venue on issues that are of concern. And so what we've attempted to do is each month we have a different theme. Our first month, the first issue that came out was on the rise of Turkey in the Arab and Muslim world. The second issue will be on Islam and the rise of Islamophobia. And then the third issue will be on the use of torture and human rights. But to have individuals talk about them from their different perspective, to try to gain areas of convergence and divergence and promote dialogue. And so, like, for example, we had President Buzek from the European Parliament. We had Dr. Falk, who's the UN Special Reporter for Human Rights, write an article. President Monia Benigni of PBC in Italy, one of the Italian political parties. Graham Watson, who's a European parliamentarian, and then we had individuals from Iran, from Malaysia, from Armenia, and then all throughout the world, and a combination between activists, academics, journalists, and political figures that wrote articles. We have about a total of 22 with unexpected 6 more coming in for the first issue, even though the first issue is already launched.
Oh, that is really incredible. And can listeners access this easily?
Oh, yes. All they have to do is go to EncompassingCrescent.com, and if they just Google it as well, it should pop up.
Oh, I encourage them to do it. You do marvelous work yourself, Rachel. And I mean, this really sounds tremendous, getting top people to write about important issues, and you can access this information. Oh, this is marvelous. So the first issue was out?
Yes, the first issue was up online. That came out May 2nd. The second issue will not come out until the first or second week in June.
Oh, well, I hope you had a very happy maiden voyage with many, many more to come.
Thank you.
Oh, Rachel, this was terrific. It was great having you on. We have to do this again. We can't wait so many months between the next time you come back on.
Yes.
So let's indeed stay in touch and do this again, and we can talk about your activities and what's going on in the region you know best. And, oh, my God, maybe I can get you on one day when things will be looking better instead of worse. That would be wonderful.
That sounds wonderful.
Rachel, many, many thanks.
Thank you very much, and good luck with the book.
Oh, thanks. And join us this weekend, of course, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. We'll have lots more good programming like this on important topics.